I think it was the end of last year, Spotify released how percentage of their catalogue that never gets played, which from memory was, you know, somewhere around above 50%. Data that's not actually providing any sort of return. We're just storing that data.
For free as well. I mean, they're not charging.
Free. They're storing it on the hope that someone's going to want to hear that song, and no one wants to hear that song. So it really puts pressure on the artists that can't market their product as effectively as other artists, which ultimately I believe is the emerging artists and the smaller artists.
Ahoy and welcome to another Musicale Focus with me, Musicale's editor Joe Sparrow, and I'm very happy to welcome to this episode Tuned Global's CEO Con Razzo. Tune Global is a B2B music streaming platform that works with brands and partners all around the world. And I wanted to speak to Con about something that sounds a little bit intangible and distant. That is the cost of storing all the music that gets streamed from our preferred service for us to listen to. But that concept has a bigger, important impact. If it's essentially free for owners of huge catalogues of music to upload their files to someone else's server, then they will. And smaller rights holders like DIY artists and independent labels are thus under increasing pressure to compete against ever-increasing volume. So we talk about what that all means and a lot more in just a minute. And if you're a fan of deliberately obtuse Mancunian post-punk bands, please stay tuned to the end for some hot chat about that. Now, if you're not familiar with Musicale Focus, it's a podcast that focuses on one music business story at a time, and thus it should be pretty quick. It should take about the same amount of time as Wu Zoyu could hypothetically inflate 30 balloons by blowing air through the tear ducts of both eyes. Wu Zoyu inflated one balloon to a diameter of 16 centimeters in 1 minute in 2011, a record that we think may not be beaten for a whole number of reasons, the main one being, why would you even do that? Anyway, talking of painfully inflating things, the number of tracks being uploaded to streaming platforms is skyrocketing for all sorts of reasons. And all of those songs carry a cost in two different ways: a storage and distribution cost, and also the pressure of competition to smaller artists. So Con and I chatted about whether DSPs should perhaps charge for storage and what the effects of that may look like for large and small rights holders. We also talked about a hypothetical future where there may be lots of small indie streaming platforms, a bit like there are lots of small independent labels. It's an interesting conversation, and here it is. So I'm very happy to welcome Tune Global's MD Con Razzo to the podcast. Hello, Con.
Hey, Joe. How you doing?
Yeah, good. Thanks for joining us. Nice to see you. Now, we're going to have a chat here about something which is quite an interesting and concept, which is the It sounds kind of mundane, but actually it's something which has quite far-reaching effects, and it's the increasing cost of storage and transmission of data of songs on various platforms. And it sort of has these wider effects on all sorts of people throughout that entire process, all the way down to artists and being paid and things like that. But before we get into that, can you just give us a little bit of quick, in a nutshell, context, who you are, what you do at Tune Global, and what Tune Global is?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the CEO and I'm a founder of Tune Global. We've been around for about 13 years or so. We are a B2B platform for people who are creating usually music streaming solutions. And so what that means is that we can provide turnkey solutions that include applications, TV interfaces, phone interfaces, etc. Or we can provide over 500 APIs for people who are really developing their own front ends, but they need all the infrastructure that goes along with music streaming. So we have about 130 million tracks on our system at the moment. And our clients really range right across the globe, and they range from startups in things like gaming or even medical, as well through to enterprise streaming services where we power telcos around the world and similar sort of organizations.
Let's talk about this topic then, because and perhaps you can just get a bit of context and some figures around this. We often hear now this figure of, well, it's either 100,000, 120,000, depending on who you speak to, songs being uploaded every day to streaming platforms. That's the top line story. Of course, that figure is debatable, depends what you consider a song, a track, and, you know, whether and how new is, right?
But we often think about the impact of that on artists in terms of them competing with other artists uploading new songs or whatever for streaming income, right? But what is the top line impact sort of beyond that of a big global business when a huge number of new files are being uploaded and moved around every day? What's the impact on a business that involves a huge volume of data being stored and moved about?
I think it's both a technical challenge and a commercial challenge, right? I mean, companies at the end of the day are trying to turn a profit from what they're providing. You know, we see organizations such as Spotify that are still struggle to turn a profit, you know, so many years in with so many millions of subscribers. So the cost base is incredibly important to bring that down to the least possible to be able to achieve that outcome. I think it's even more so that when you're perhaps getting started and providing a niche streaming service or a broad-based streaming service, you really want to focus your efforts into marketing, not into all the infrastructure that goes along with providing a music service. So there's definitely how do you deal with these very large amounts of data flowing through that you need to store? And to put that into context for a sec, we get deliveries from all different labels every single day, from major labels through to independent labels. But it's not just the first delivery that you get. It's every update that comes through, which sometimes the updates can be certainly as many as the deliveries. And from our perspective, we not only have to store the original delivery for audit purposes, but we have to store every single update that ever came through. And everyone really has to do that to be able to be ensured that in an audit, they're able to say, yeah, we played something that had the rights because here's the data that came through at the time that said these were the rights that were associated with it. So it's incredibly impactful. And so finding a solution that can deliver predominantly commercially, but then is also, I guess, both technically robust and I'm going to say technically simple. That's going to be a crazy sort of word. But, you know, how do you actually able to achieve these outcomes of reducing these costs on so much storage? And when we're talking about storage, we're probably talking about 35 to 40 terabytes per million tracks, right? So you're talking about, in our situation, petabytes of data that is just music streaming being stored, right, on service.
Hmm. What's a sort of ballpark figure for how much it costs to store and deliver all this data? I mean, there's a storage cost and then there's a sort of delivery cost to the end user.
Yeah, distribution cost. Yeah, for sure. I think it really varies on the end solution and what the company is providing. Do they have lossless in their mix? Do they support other audio formats? You know, we support video formats. Are they supporting video formats as well? What does that mean? We haven't really talked about video much at this stage. So all those things really impact what the final cost model is. If you look at, you know, if you go to AWS, Amazon Web Services, and look at what their costs are per terabyte, it's about $30 per terabyte per month. So you can see if you're storing petabytes of this, it quickly can become either very high five figures or low six figures per month. So it's impactful.
Although I guess for a streaming platform in the context of one that brings in billions of dollars a month, it's still a sort of small figure, but what are the sort of rolling impacts of this? You know, what the continued growth of this storage and the infrastructure and the need to sort of stay on top of it. Does it, you know, from a small indie label perspective, they say, well, okay, every year we upload to these streaming platforms maybe 100 songs, and that's a very small amount of individual files and data, right? It's pretty small. So they might feel like, well, how does this affect me, right? It's not like we have a catalog of 10 million songs, but so how does it affect artists and labels, and does it affect a certain size of artist and label more than other?
Recently, there, I think it was the end of last year, Spotify released how percentage of their catalogue that never gets played, which from memory was, you know, somewhere around above 50% that never actually got used over a 12-month period. So you're now talking about analysing as a business the data that's not actually providing any sort of return. You're just storing that data.
For free as well. I mean, they're not charging. Free.
No, they're not. Yeah, exactly. So they're receiving the data, they're storing it on the hope that someone's going to want to hear that song, and no one wants to hear that song. So it really puts pressure on the artists that can't market their product as effectively as other artists, which ultimately I believe is the emerging artists and the smaller artists, because they're most likely going to be generating the lower levels of play. I mean, in a sense, we've seen recently with Spotify around, you know, the 1,000 plays and you're not going to get paid if you're an artist. And I think all these go towards... In that case, it's probably for different reasons and different commercial models, but I think that all these things will be impactful to those smaller artists, and services really have to question the value and quality of the content that they're bringing out and making available in the context of their whole business model. You mentioned earlier that that number wasn't necessarily high, and I do agree with you. When you look at a Spotify, it's not that high. But when you look at, say, what the profit, the margin that some of these services are operating on, which is wafer thin, being able to save $1 million or more is still something worth looking at in that process. Mm. And certainly for emerging services, you know, that's perhaps the difference between success and failure.
We recently published a guest post on Music Ally, which is written by Martin Mills of Beggars Group, Darius van Armen of Secretly Distribution, and Stefan Bordoiseau of Wagram Stories. Oh, and Emmanuel de Bourtel of Because Music. And it was a jointly written guest post. And these are obviously sort of notable players in the independent space. They argue that indie artists are being punished by the volume of songs being uploaded by huge catalog owners. This sort of fits in with the storage costs conversation, doesn't it? What do you think about that position?
I think that certainly the larger catalog owners wield a lot of power. And so they have more influence on many things, including commercial models and experimenting with different commercial models and a whole bunch of other areas down that sort of space. I do think that I agree. I agree that as an indie artist, you have to be able to be, you have to be able to market yourself effectively. And I think a little bit off track on what we're talking about at the moment, I think it's really the emergence of how do you allow artists to do that on platforms, to be seen and to be able to connect with fans. Because otherwise you're penalising them because they don't have enough streams, but you're not giving them the opportunity to be heard that other stakeholders can have because they wield more power, right? Now, I do think there's indies and indies, right? You know, so there's true independent artists that, you know, real micro artists that are publishing from various self-publishing platforms. And I think they're the ones that are most at risk of being charged additional fees versus independent artists that still might be going effectively through larger aggregators or distributors to make their content available on digital services.
Hmm. So, I mean, obviously with any system, a mature system, as music streaming is now, it's certainly in its maturation phase.
Yeah.
You will see the bigger stakeholders. You know, we have three major labels. You know, they seem to be doing fine out of the current system because, you know, they have all this data, all these tracks, and they just move them from here over here, and then they say to the DSPs, okay, this is, you look after them, that's your problem now, and then you give us 65% of the money as the rights holders. And that's a very simplified way of looking at it, right? But they have volume, and it's a volume game in that sense. That's how they view it. But from a, as you said, an independent artist, a true independent or even a quasi-independent, they're not dealing with volume. They're dealing with art and careers and building communities, right? That's where their value comes from. As a sort of keeping this concept of storage and all the costs involved with that process in mind, what are alternatives to this existing system? If the one at the moment is really benefiting big catalog holders?
That's a complex question because it probably goes beyond. And so I do think that enabling, certainly not creating systems that further disadvantage independent artists are really critical. So when you look at the current growth of catalogs, and, you know, most people are saying that at the moment it's on the horizon that we might have 450 million tracks that are available, right, which is a significant number. And, you know, as we all know, whether generative AI plays a role in that or not over the next few years, I'm sure it will to an extent. To what extent, it's still a little bit of an unknown. I think all that drives certainly something that's on the table at the moment to say, should you charge people for storage of their catalog, right? And so effectively, perhaps if a certain amount of streams occur, they don't get a charge, but otherwise they do get a charge or there is a flat charge. But as you mentioned earlier, really the people who are struggling the most will be penalized through that process, which is artists that just are emerging and they just want to start to get their product out there. So I think it's up to us to continue to innovate around also technical solutions that can reduce those costs. And I think they're out there, right? When you look at companies such as, you know, Spotify, Apple Music, you know, the huge ones, TikTok, etc., they are organizations that certainly have the scale to be operating their own infrastructure. But when you look at all the services around the world, and there's so many of them in every market, you know, we're powering services in Greenland, Kazakhstan, Ethiopia. I mean, these are all services that have millions of users on them, right, in that process. And in those situations, I think we're still getting companies that approach us and say, oh, shall I build that infrastructure myself? I don't think that's possible in the future. I think you have to find ways that you can group storage together and make it available, not only for commercial impacts like we discussed, but also for the environmental impact, that when you think about how much of exactly the same music is stored in exactly the same way around the world, it's almost a travesty in terms of the impact in the environment through that.
Well, process. I was about to say, I'm sure that, you know, let's take some of the big players. Apple Music, Spotify, and Amazon Music are all storing exactly the same files, probably in exactly the same server centers, and it's all being served differently. And this doesn't make sense, right? This is...
Joe, I would say that it's not four or five. I would say it's 100 or 200 DSPs that are doing that. So it just is huge. Now, certainly companies like us play a role there because we can now centralize that. We think reduce the cost significantly for people who are accessing companies like us. So it plays a role both in their commercial model and also in, you know, just the resource footprint that you put behind that. But beyond that, we're still talking about traditional systems there. I think some of the more really interesting things that we are experimenting with as well is decentralized storage, where it's encrypted and truly decentralized, and can we lower costs of storage through those processes? At the moment, I'm going to say that they're not strikingly lower, those decentralized costs at the moment. Mm. We think that is certainly a pathway over the next 5 years.
How does that work? Can you just explain the difference between, let's say, the standard, sure, let's say, centralized storage model and a decentralized, yep, model?
Sure, sure. So in a centralized storage model where we have all the assets, we've probably got multiple copies of those assets for disaster reasons and all those sort of things, but we store those effectively on what people would see as traditional servers. Sure, they're in the cloud, but at the end of the day, they're spinning on some hard disk or something similar to that process, and they're all together. So you have to secure them. You have to make sure that who has access to them, all these other elements that are really important, and the rights holders find as important. In a decentralized storage system, it's effectively that small chunks of those files are being stored all across the internet in people that participate within a decentralized storage system. Could be individuals, could be corporations. They're all encrypted, and on their own, they're next to useless. So it becomes an incredibly secure model as well as a more cost-effective model.
So anybody can become a sort of a small part of a giant global storage farm. A little bit like, I mean, I guess the analogy is cryptocurrency, isn't it? Becoming a node for something like that.
Certainly they're leading the way in a number of those elements, and, you know, Web3 is leading some of that way. But I do think, you know, the opportunities that they present, but you have to be constantly researching this and say, when we're at that 450 million tracks, how do you actually make sure that you're just as cost effective there as you are now? And as you mentioned at the start, this isn't the really fun marketing stuff about music, right? And, you know, the edge. But without it, you can't then build a sustainable business behind it. So someone's got to look at it.
One of the interesting things you were hinting at there is you were saying, like, you have lots of localized streaming platforms all around the world. And that is in itself a fascinating thing, isn't it? About the sort of the different needs of different cultures of and the kind of services that are provided for them and the different music and the way that music is provided for them. That's one interesting thing in itself. In the past, let's say in the 1980s, late 70s, 1980s, the rise of independent record labels, where, you know, people figured out that they could do it themselves and they could sign a contract on a napkin, press up a small number of pieces of vinyl, do the distribution themselves in a van around a couple of major cities and sort of get something going there. I'm wondering if there's a parallel here. If we assume at the moment that music consumption is you open your phone, you pick one of four big name services, you subscribe to that one for a flat fee and you get everything. That's, you know, it's normalized, but that's not normalized in the other aspects of the music industry where we say, okay, I'm going to support this artist, this small independent label because I like their approach and what they're doing and the music they're making. And we sort of accept that that's different, that you won't walk into your like a big, if you do have a local record store left, a big one and find that specific record. You might have to mail order it. You might have to do it some other way. Could we be entering a phase where there's some bespoke streaming platforms like that for a small niche audience? And what would they look like? And what would their sort of payment structure be? And how would that work?
This is the stuff I really love. So thanks for asking the question.
You're welcome.
I think, you know, what's really interesting at the moment is that first of all, absolutely, you look at even what Apple's doing with their classical music service versus their traditional music service, and they're actually brought out something because they understand that that audience wants a different experience than the traditional Apple Music audience. So it really comes down to not just the music, but I guess the interfaces, what's important to you when you do these things. I guess, you know, my big prediction of the future and where the opportunities are probably in the future is I certainly think that the evolution and where we're seeing AI potentially play a role within interfaces and essentially abstract the interface from the user service that's from behind it. So now you can subscribe to something that's highly specialized, but the interface that you receive may be a single interface, an AI-generated interface that's in there in that purpose. I would say the reason why people don't, whenever you think of multiple streaming services, similar, say, to movie streaming services, we all know about app fatigue. Can we get someone else to download another application? What about if that doesn't matter? What about if people can just access their phone to get to the music they want, but the service they subscribe to really hones in on the music they love and presents it in a way that's possible? So I think that API economy from those DSPs, how they make their music and services available to be consumed in different interfaces, certainly will be something that's really interesting in the future. Will the major players go down that route? Wouldn't have any clue on that. But certainly I would see that the variety of niche streaming services that we're providing that have a real demand across the globe would certainly benefit from that. So I do think there's a lot happening in technology today that only allows for more niche services, not less, right?
Going back to that guest post I mentioned by Martin Mills et al., one suggestion that really stood out for me was they said, well, look, hey, they're, of course, approaching this from the perspective of indie artists are getting crushed by catalog. And I'm hearing this, by the way, from if I talk to independent labels, they're saying to me, well, you know, streaming has been good to us for the last, let's say, 8 to 10 years. And now we're starting to feel the squeeze again because there's so much volume out there and it's pushing us out sort of imperceptibly out of playlists. And because every song is as valid as any other song on a streaming platform, when you start to pump in this huge volume, we're getting squeezed out and all of a sudden our income is shrinking a bit. Now, and I think that's a position that anybody who loves music can sort of feel sympathetic to, because we need these new entrants and we need passionate people who are supplying a lot of different music to the market. So their suggestion was, okay, let's recognize that there's a storage cost and DSPs could, quote, charge a small flat amount for every track delivered, same to everybody, and that money goes to a pot that recognizes that there are costs involved with uploading and storage tracks that doesn't specifically create value for the service, right? Just purely on the cost side. And of course, for independent artists, if you say, okay, it's going to cost you a dollar a year to store a track on a streaming platform, it's small beer, right? But for a company dumping 50,000 tracks a week or more, it's sudden the costs mount up. Do you think that this is a sort of approach that could work?
I think when you start looking at the potential of generative AI flooding that market to be able to take a percentage of pool-based revenue, if it's pool-based, from the service, and now incurring a cost on a product that's not necessarily going to get them that return, I think that's a really interesting angle. I think it's an interesting angle that potentially helps the independent artists because it stops the factory production of music that just floods that market, right? So I do think that's interesting. I think the flat fee is always a difficult piece to get all stakeholders to agree on.
Yep.
So I love the idea. I think in practicality, will there be agreement? I think that becomes who wields the most power. And ultimately, you know, is much more challenging. I would love to see, though, how a flat fee model, where do those fees actually go? How do they actually help the music industry? Are they going directly just to offset costs, or is there other benefits to that process? I think the dialogue is great. How we move it into something that's actionable is really the critical step, rather than just say, no, here, now, suddenly it's just more expensive for every independent. And I don't think it is a dollar. I think if once independents start getting charged here, there'll be a real potentially have and have nots, you know, a class system within music. And I think, you know, for me, that's really to be avoided. It's really about giving independent artists or emerging artists the opportunity to grow.
Yeah, okay. Lots to think about there. I'll put some links to you and Tune Global beneath the podcast for people to check out. One final question. We've talked about, you know, an important but dry topic around the music. We've been talking about moving music around, but let's talk about if you could pick one piece of music to move around and listen to for the rest of your life, what would it be? It can be an album or an individual song. I'm feeling like,
oh gosh, wouldn't that be crazy? I mean, I'm a love child of the I guess the British Invasion, and I still go back to my classics from that particular time, right? And you know, I was rifling through my Dead Kennedys the other day and the like. Okay. So I think as much as I love going out and hearing new music, I'd still be going back to my core roots of early 80s and just really getting into that stuff.
Right. So, Con, are we saying that you'd be the first person to suggest that the record you listen to for the rest of your life would be a Dead Kennedys record? Are we kind of narrowing you down to this?
Yeah, let's go with it. If I was going to choose one, I think, you know, a band that I absolutely followed everywhere when they came out here from the UK back in the 80s was The Fall. Absolutely. And I would say, I'm not sure about rest of your life. You might want to have a very short life, but it would be a fun life in any case.
As an ex-resident of Manchester, I lived there for 10 years. I'm intimately acquainted with the Fall's catalogue. And maybe this is somewhere where we could cut you a bit of slack and say you can have the entire Fall catalogue because there's a lot of variety there. And
There is a lot of variety.
A lot of content as well for a band that released an album every year for 30, 40 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Keep you busy. All right. I will give you The Fall. You're the first person to have The Fall as well. So respect. All right. Thanks, Con Razzo. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joe. Great.
And there you go. So if you found that useful, please share the podcast on with someone else who you think will get something out of it. And if you want to get in touch with me, I would, of course, love to hear from you. You can email me on joe@musically.com. That's Joe, J-O-E, @musically.com. We also have a free weekly email called The Knowledge, which rounds up a soupçon of the best news, analysis, marketing insight, and skills from across Music Ally's broad range of services. So sign up and impress your boss. Links are below the podcast, as well as to a bunch of things that Con and I discussed in the interview. And that's it. So thank you for listening. As ever, I've been Joe Sparrow. You have been you. And until next time, farewell.